Welcome back to The Fire Break. I'm Steve Wolf. The Fire Break, sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing new tactics and technology to reduce wildland fatalities and property loss. I have like a killer all-star guest today. I've got Ray Chaney, who is currently the emergency manager for the city of San Diego, and previously has held like every major title from, you know, type one incident commander, battalion chief, technology guy. I mean, Ray, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, thanks, Steve. Pleasure to be on. Just one quick correction. I work for NGO called 211 San Diego, and I'm the director of emergency services for 211 San Diego. So
for 211. Okay, yeah. I got it. You know, I looked at it and I thought 211 was like, you know, they have 911, and then for information, there's 311. And I thought maybe for fire, it's a 211 thing. So it's not a phone number that you call. It's a company.
It's a 3-digit dialing code you can call, and we leverage that number when there's large-scale disasters in the county of San Diego to get public information out. So instead of trying to remember a bunch of 10-digit numbers, the public can call 211, and we'll have all the information on whether what's going on with the incident, mostly wildfires, and then, you know, road closures, shelter information. So it's one-stop shopping for all sources of information.
Okay. So is 211 a... It's a public service?
Yes,
the services office, or how does that work?
We're a nonprofit, but we have contracts and agreements with County Office of Emergency Services, Cal Fire San Diego, and a couple of small municipalities in the county.
Okay. So I was, I thought I was right, but I was wrong. But then it turned out I was right after all.
You're right.
What a confusing morning. So Ray, I understand, you know, that this is difficult for you. To have to come on this podcast, you know, after Dan Reese.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Dan Reese.
You know,
nobody likes Dan Reese.
Authoritative, like what the, you know, tough act to follow.
Yeah. You know, truth be told, between me and you, and I know nobody will ever see this, but Dan Reese, nobody likes him. You know, he's a horrible person. No, he's a good friend of mine. And like we were joking, I'm always jealous of him because he's better looking and smarter than me. So, I'm a little trepidatious to follow in the footsteps of a Dan Reese.
All right. Well, I'm going to give you the best coaching I can and
Perfect.
Set you up with really great questions and, you know, see if you can, you know, have him living in your shadow.
Yes. That'd be fantastic. Something right, to hold over his head.
Let's do it then. So why don't we start with your career? How did you end up, in the fire space?
My dad was a hotshot for the U.S. Forest Service. And then turned out to be my godfather worked for the Forest Service as well. My dad was an El Carrizo hotshot back in the 60s. So my dad ended up taking a different career, mostly working on education. My godfather stayed in and, was working for CDF, California Department of Forestry, now Cal Fire. Back in the day. And my dad and I would do ride-alongs with my uncle, yep. Uncle Bill. His name is Bill Clayton. And that just hooked me. That's what I wanted to do. So I'm still in high school. I ditched a week of high school to go to the basic 40-hour seasonal firefighter academy, so to speak. Yep. And ever since then, it's just been a great ride. So seasonal firefighter in Temecula, Southern California, and then LT engineer. I worked up in Tulare County for a little while, up by Visalia, Wood Lake area. And LT engineer is you're basically a seasonal driver operator, so you drive the fire engine for the summer and then you're laid off. And then I got picked up full-time with San Luis Obispo unit on the central coast of California and spent about 12 years of my career there. So from being a full-time engineer driving a Type 3 wildland engine to a lot of counties in California contract with Cal Fire to be their county fire department. So here in San Diego, the San Diego County Fire Department is Cal Fire under a contract. San Luis Obispo is the same way. So there is a county fire component to that. So a municipal side to it. And I transferred into the airport fire station where I worked, believe it or not, I worked on a crash truck for an airport, worked on a medium rescue and then a regular type one engine. So that was a really great experience because probably the best part of my career was being on the technical rescue team, where we did a lot of really cool high speed stuff in water, swift water, surf rescue, I ended up on the USAR team eventually here in San Diego, Urban Search and Rescue Task Force 8, went to Katrina. And then when I was in San Luis Obispo unit, the writing on the wall is if you wanted to be a captain, you had to be a crew captain. So I ended up running an inmate fire crew for about 4 years down in Ventura area, Ventura, California. And then I got my dream job as a air tactical group supervisor flying out of Paso Robles. So that was an amazing thing. And John Gibson was the chief, and he was very progressive at the time. So most of that, that's a very coveted job in the department, being an air attack captain. And back then we were flying out of the old O2 Skymaster, the push-pull plane, Cessna 337 out of Paso Robles. But when I went up for my interview, it was actually a quote assessment center, and he had 10 workstations inside this building, and you went from each station and you were assessed on your score. And that was great. And so he gave me my dream shot and ended up being that. And then eventually promoted to battalion chief down here in San Diego around 2000.
Okay.
And I was in a field position there and in the Campo area. Cedar fire hits 2003, the first quote modern day mega fire, and was first on that. And then a whole bunch of things came out of the Cedar fire, a lot of great improvements to the San Diego unit, and development of a lot of aviation stuff. So at the time, they needed some aviation background, which I had. And we ended up developing programs with the U.S. military and the San Diego Sheriff's Department that are still in place today. They're very unique for San Diego. So kind of nice to, we're one of the only places in the United States that can access Title 10 aviation resources with a phone call from our dispatch center to the senior watch officer for Navy Third Fleet or Marine Corps Installations West. So we can access those resources.
That's a lot of power at the end of a phone
call. Hours of time. So before it would take us 3 days because it had to go all the way to the SecDef to get approved and then come back down. So by then in Southern California, fires are gone. So so that worked out really well. And then I eventually got transferred into the role of the air attack officer or the battalion chief in charge of air operations in San Diego. And I flew out of Ramona for about 9 years, flying air attack out of there and running air operations. And then the 07 fire siege hit, 2007 fire siege hit. And there was a lot of different things. All the benefits that came out of the 03 fire siege, we applied to the 07 fire siege, and it worked out really well. And then I drank the Kool-Aid and promoted to assistant chief into a local fire district. And about 2 years later, that's when I retired. So, yeah,
it was wow. Great ride. What year was that?
I retired in 2015.
Okay. Well, you don't look retired. You look like you're still pretty busy with stuff.
Yeah, I was retired for about 6 months, and then I got bored and had to go back to work.
Okay. And so what lured you back to the job that you're in now?
I really like building programs, mm-hmm. kind of from scratch. So whether it's fire technology, writing, and these guys were in the infancy of helping the public with large scale emergency information. And I just was really intrigued by the company, and it's an amazing organization, great leadership. We do a lot for the community, so it's very satisfying.
And I hadn't heard of 211 before, but yeah, I'm lucky. I'm glad that I guessed that it was, you know, some 911 variant.
Yeah.
Is it interactive, or you call and you hear a message and it says, you know, get out, stay, shelter in place.
Avoid the traffic. you'll get a message into our, what we call interactive voice response system and say, press 1 for English, 2 for Spanish, you know, and then you'll get a menu of different things. And then one of them will be say, if you're calling about the, let's say the Lilac fire, press 1, and then you would get information on that, or you'd go to a live person. And so We're always open 24/7, and you're always going to end up talking to a live person, a real person.
Really? And ultimately?
Yep.
And how many people does it take to do that?
A lot. So we're right out. We supported COVID heavily here with in San Diego with Health and Human Services.
Yeah.
So our staff almost doubled. So we went from like 125 to almost 300 staff in a very short period of time. But we have a scalable response within 211. So we actually have our own incident management team that I built internal.
Okay.
So we go from daytime operations to dark skies where we go into a paramilitary organization. So we have an incident commander, we have an operations, we have branches, we have finance, we have logistics, all internal just to our company, just to run things. And then we have a surge of staff between volunteers and then also county workers that we've trained in our technology.
I see. So you have, you know, really more scalable as an incident grows, your capacity grows.
That's a perfect way to describe it. It's very scalable. So anything from a type 3 organization up to all hands on deck, it's type 1 organization.
It looks like throughout your career, you've always had a fascination, not just with the job and the mission, but with the technology of doing it.
I don't know why, but it's just a niche that I always enjoyed, the technology side of it. So how can we apply technology and in the term I use, they'll call the tired, dirty, hungry firefighter, and make their job easier, make it more intuitive, or validate their thoughts on what's going on with the incident. So I had a really unique opportunity where MIT Lincoln Labs was doing a program called CPOF, or Command Post of the Future. That was for the military. And they wanted to apply that to the fire service. And they ended up calling it the Next Generation Incident Command System, or NICS, N-I-C-S. And that was using technology like automatic vehicle location, AVL, real-time screen sharing, real-time writing on your screen, and you're doing collaborative whiteboarding over a network in your vehicle or in your dispatch center or whatever the case may be. So we work a lot on that. And so we have these great scientists, and I call myself a knuckle dragging firefighter. And I just say, you know, this is not going to work in the field. And this is why I can't type a bunch of things, because usually when you're tired, trying to type anything logical is crazy. So everything needs to be pull down menu, click button, easy to navigate. So trying to design technology very robust behind the scenes, but with a simple interface was the challenge that we had. So, and that worked out. And then as an offshoot of that, I was flying, AirTAC out of Ramona. And even to this day, Air Tactical Group supervisors are giving verbal descriptions of what's going on. Like, okay, your left flank is doing this, your right flank's doing this. I recommend you maybe do this on this shoulder, or I can start anchoring retardant helicopters on this side and do this and pincher movement. And I'm basically using words to describe what I'm seeing to the incident commander on the ground who I'm working for. That's kind of ridiculous in this day and age of, you know, what's going on. So we ended up developing a camera, dual IR EO camera, so visual and infrared camera, on the bottom of the OB-10 Bronco, interfaced to a mobile data computer, like a Toughbook inside there, and used a game controller to control the camera. And so the cool part was, being an ATGS, my primary job is aviation safety. So making sure the airspace is safe, talking strategy with the IC on the ground, but number one, keeping everybody in the air and on the ground safe. And to be honest, there was a lot of questions about, well, is this going to be a distraction to that primary mission? And I said, yeah, it could be, but we're going to train to deconflict that. So when we built that camera, we could lock the camera in place and then just go in and do our normal job. So once I caught into orbit, one of the things I would do is I'd lock the camera onto the main center of the target of the fire, so that everybody on the ground could see it, because we're streaming this video down to our battalion chief vehicles, even to our phones, we could do it. And then I said, well, I was talking to the MIT guys. I'm like, well, what if somebody wants to take control of the camera? Like, I'm too busy, because it's a complex airspace, And we just don't want this camera pointing at the sky or pointing at the nose of the aircraft. So right. we did what we call a handshake, where the person on the ground could, I could disable my controls, enable their controls, and they could, with their game controller in their battalion chief vehicle, control my camera. So if they wanted to look at something, they could take a look at it. We started to get to the point where our southern operations, like our south ops, could take control of the camera, so they could look at things strategically, like big picture stuff, you know, like do we need to order 10 more strike teams to this fire or what's going on? So, so that was really exciting, kind of piggybacking onto the MIT project.
That's really interesting, the idea. And of course, now those technologies are more ubiquitous, right? I can open my phone and I can go to any one of the cameras in my house and I can point it where I want to.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And this was 10 years ago we were doing it. So it was pretty cutting edge. Yeah. Pretty cutting edge. And I know Cal Fire is doing some of that. OES is doing some of that with some of their King Airs now. I don't know if they're streaming or not, but it was always challenging. Especially in San Diego, we have pretty heavy EMI or electromagnetic interference, because we've got so many DoD contractors here in San Diego that they're streaming all kinds of things into the air that nobody knows about, like frequency wise. So it's always a challenge to do that. But yeah.
I mean, I guess you have to work around that, because you're not going to hardwire tether your aerial cameras down to, right. You're not cat 8 cable running up to your airplane.
Yeah. Always a challenge. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you wrote to me after the Dan Reese episode, and you referenced the AI that we were talking about. And really what we were discussing, and I really want to get your thoughts on this, was the idea that the best function of computers might not be to simply contribute to the overload of incident commanders, but to actually help them formulate response plans.
Because, yeah, exactly.
You could teach an AI, you know, this plane can drop so much retardant every so often, and this helicopter can, you know, impact this 30-foot radius, and right. So if you were to think of that like a chess match, you know, each one of your aerial and ground assets can do certain things over a certain amount of time, then why wouldn't we look to AI to do not just, you know, data support, but decision, they call it decision support, but really to formulate the plan and then just ask for a sign off on it, because it could game out so many different ways that a fire could be done, you know, way beyond just what the sweaty guys in the IC trailer come up with.
Yeah. And I've you're the first person that gets it that I've heard say it. So that's exactly right. So when we were building technology, especially like with the next generation incident command system, it was assistive technology to decision making. So intuitively, as an IC or an operations, I know, based on my years of experience, all my slides of experience and my carousel in my brain, right. We apply that recognized prime decision making, you know, RPD. So how can we use AI? And remember, AI is really great for large databases. So, right. So how about we start using AI in a fashion that helps validate decision making, strategic decision making, evacuation corridors, community evacuation corridors, and then even apply it to pre-fire engineering or planning prior to an incident. But if you can take the entire data set of every fire, every recorded, and put it into the AI database, overlay the spreads, the time of year the fire occurred, the fuel model the fire was in, apply all that, and now apply that to your fire spread prediction modeling and your softwares.
Yep.
So you're applying history and right. you're applying current weather and current projected weather to give you some strategic decision-making on where you think you want to establish your control lines. Like, you don't want to establish your control lines because our weather modeling is showing up that you're going to go from an offshore to an onshore, which is if you recall, is the number one fatality for all wildland fires is Santa Ana winds blow hard east to west. And then there is a transition day. And that happened on the Cedar Fire. That's where Steve Rucker was killed. That was the transition day where it was hot, hard blowing winds east to west, and then the transition of the normal onshore flow. There's actually some great video from what they call the HP Ren cameras, High Performance Wireless Research Education Network out of UCSD. It's all these cameras that we now there's Alert California, but back then these cameras were recording all, and there's great video of all the smoke going out to the ocean. And then all of a sudden you see the smoke lift and it starts coming back to the camera. Wow. And so, yeah. So how do you apply that technology, with our current programs? Like, I know we work collaboratively with SDG&E, San Diego Gas and Electric, and they've done some pretty amazing technology, especially in spread prediction, using supercomputers. So let's overlay that AI information onto our current weather. And you could even do probabilities of ignition for a certain day.
That's right.
And okay, so everything's human, right? Everything's human activity, right? So 99% are human caused. So I can tell you where I live, in Alpine, on certain times of the year, every Friday, everybody's headed to the desert, and it's all the RV trailers and all the toy haulers. They're going up Interstate 8. That is a source of ignition on a certain section of road from, you know, El Cajon up towards, you know, Alpine. There's a steady grade where all those vehicles are pulling trailers and they're going to blow out some catalytic converter, hot piece of metal, and then there's an ignition. So that's just an example of looking at time of year, human activity, fire history, current weather conditions, and applying that all in one large database and decision-making network.
Yeah, right. You take the AI and you say, here is your open access to every data bit from every fire that we have data on. And you're going to run this in timeline so you can see what all the correlations are. And then you're going to understand the current data. And then based on the current data, historically, that's what this leads to. And then here, we're going to query the computer-aided dispatch system to find out what equipment is available right away, at what distance, how long it's going to take to get there, what the fire is going to look like by the time it gets there, and then generate your continually updated optimal suppression plan. And because the AI doesn't charge for overtime, you could start generating suppression plans for fires that haven't happened yet. Using your predictive model, right? You say, well, there's a high likelihood there's going to be a fire here.
Right.
Here's what you're going to need to be able to do when that happens.
Yeah.
And I suggest getting everything out of the parking lot at the airport and getting it all up there because you're probably going to need it.
Yeah. And then let's apply it in what I think is the next logical step in fire suppression is we need to get better at pre-fire projects, pre-fire engineering. So let's use that to game scenarios, use the AI technology to game ignition, put points of ignition in certain parts of a map, let it run, let the model work. And then that can be, the impetus for vegetation management projects, prescribed burning, mechanized, mastication of, stuff like that. So I think from a fire service standpoint, we've gotten really good at response and suppression. We're still behind the power curve when it comes to pre-fire engineering and doing the work before, but it has to be in a risk-averse modality. So prescribed burning is excellent, but it's always a risk. You let that genie out of the bottle or the tiger out of the cage, whatever acronym you want to use, and there is a chance that that's going to escape and it's going to happen. It's happened historically. It's going to happen again. And the problem is we're in such a litigious state, California, that it's everybody's. When I put fire in the ground, when I was, it frightened me because I'm like, what if? I don't want to be responsible for somebody's home burning down or, God forbid, somebody getting hurt. So how can we use that AI technology to improve our efforts prior to an incident taking place?
Well, you said that through 2-1-1, you're active during COVID, And, you know, you could really compare these, you know, putting fire on the ground, prescribed burns to vaccinations, right? Yes, some percentage of them are going to get out of control, and some percentage of people are going to have an allergic reaction to some ingredient in a vaccine. That doesn't mean that on the whole, they're not really good to do.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I think we're in a really interesting time with as far as the technology goes, because there's a lot of problems that can be resolved through technology and private industry. Situational awareness, I think, is huge. So if we can increase our SA or situational awareness on the fire ground and prevent incidents like the Yarnell fire, you know, where 19 hotshots lose their lives because SA was compromised. That's one of the things I really support the use of UASs, unmanned systems. Even at a micro level, I was proposing back in the day, the Marine Corps got these little micro, you know, drones that are the size of a little baby toy helicopter, but they're fantastic. They're very stable, very light. You can pull that out of your pocket, send it downhill. When I was a crew captain cutting line downhill is pretty hairy because, you know, you're downhill, which, and you've got fire below you or fire to the flank of you. Be nice to be able to run a drone down the canyon and just see exactly where everything's at before we start cutting. Things like that. There's a lot of things. So situational awareness is another one. I think, you know, to Dan's program with the 747, and then I was fortunate to be on the DC-10 development program. So myself and Dan Ward were the two guys under the direction of Mike Padilla, who was in charge of aviation management back then. 2006, we went basically to every fire with the VLAT, the DC-10's first year. One of us flew in the lead plane in the OV-10 with Bob Coward, which was the first Cal Fire lead plane pilot. And then I was the ATGS, I'd be in the back. And then Dan or I would trade spots on board the DC-10. So one of us would ride shotgun in the DC-10, one of us would be in the lead plane, and we'd go to, Dan and I would just trade. So I got the opportunity to be on the very first drop of the DC-10 on the Sawtooth fire. And it was very interesting because it's like you're driving this airliner 300 feet off the ground, and it's like you're in a pickup truck on an old dirt road, just shaking and shimmying. And back then, everybody was so afraid of it that they literally evacuated some of the fire line because they were afraid that somebody was going to get hurt. And I remember we were downwind, and literally every helicopter on that fire was lined up on a ridge line watching this thing for the first time. So we're going down, we're downwind, going to turn base to final. And I look over, and it's a whole string of helicopters in a hover just watching, because it was like, this is going to be crazy to watch this thing drop. And we turned around, made the final, and made our drop, got out of there. And that was the very first time we'd ever done it. And then for the rest of that year, we went everywhere in the state with that thing, you know, whether it was fires in Central Coast. We even went to Moses Lake, Washington for an assignment out of state through like an interstate compact. So that was really interesting. And I think, so there's some technology stuff. Where I was going with that is right now we're using helos at night in a limited basis because it's, you know, very risky. And I think that's great. But I think there's technology out there in the future where we can use fixed wing aircraft at night, especially VLATs, where you're dropping a lot of retardant at a time. If you look at it, retardant is really an energy management tool. So you apply retardant to reduce energy output of the fire so that your organization, whether it's mechanized bulldozer or hand crews or hose lays, can get in close enough proximity to it to suppress it. But retardant's really good at night because if you think about it, your wind is going down, your relative humidity is going up, and at the right time, at the right place, a drop at night or multiple drops at night, especially ridge tops, or if you're going to hold a fire at a certain area where there's good ingress and egress and there's no aerial hazards, I think eventually night VLAT drops will be a thing of the future. I hope that, again, that's going to go back to private industry and having them be able to develop that.
Yeah, which brings me to three more questions. One, to what degree do you think we're going to see the most dangerous, you know, human fire interface jobs replaced with robots that we care less about and that we can give more dangerous assignments to?
It's funny you say that, because I was trying to get a hold of a certain robotic company to talk to them about it, because I've got some ideas on that. And I think it kind of goes back to a generational workforce. So, you know, I know a lot of departments are having challenges filling the job, which to me is crazy, because
the robots up for the work. Yeah.
It's the best job in the world, I think. And sure, when I was a seasonal firefighter, our work week was 5 days a week. You worked 5 days straight. You had 2 days off. And I'll tell you what, 18 out of high school, I would have worked all 7 days, because I just had such, it was so fun to do and such exciting. And we got paid almost nothing. Now with this workforce, how are we going to hire enough wildland firefighters to stay up 12 hours, 24 hours, 36 hours in arduous conditions, in the middle of nowhere, just working your butt off? I mean, so who's going to replace that workforce? You know, how are we going to get how are we going to get the hosely up the hill?
Right. So, I mean, if you're not going to let them bring their Nintendo and their PlayStation with them, they're not going.
Right. So I definitely see robotics coming into the future very quickly. You know, I think there's going to be a workforce shortage just based on that next generation of able-bodied workers. Do they want to be a wildland firefighter? What's their motivation? Are we paying them well? Some agencies are paying they're not even calling them firefighters. They're getting paid horribly. I think there is definitely a future for robotics in the fire service.
Yeah. I think
to do that, you know, and there's definitely some technology, even from a municipal side, you know, whether you're working a commercial structure fire or you're doing an interior search. You know, I was a trench rescue guy. I was a confined space rescue person. So how about adaptive technology, micro robotics, to be able to send in and do victim search?
Absolutely. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah. People are building that for sure. So, when you were describing I'll call them adventures that you had with Dan, because, you know, yes, you happen to be on the clock getting paid, but you probably wouldn't have chosen to be anywhere else at the time, because it's just incredibly exciting opportunity. You know, that has you looking back and thinking, man, you know, serious glory days right there. So it sounds to me, Ray, like your challenge is, you know, what is going to be in your future that is going to be more exciting than what's been in your past? And that's a pretty high bar to set. But you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I look back and I go, how did I get into this? You know, how did I get into those programs? You know, I felt so lucky. Just number one, getting into the fire service career. And I have this story I tell where I had that epiphany that, like, you're pretty lucky what you're doing. So
right,
we're on a technical rescue team assignment. We're doing training with the Air Force, the 76th helicopter flight out of Vandenberg Air Force Base. And we're doing water insertions off the coast of Avila Beach, doing surf rescue. And so we're sitting on the deck of this Huey helicopter, got our fins on, our helmets on, PFDs. And what we're doing is we're dropping one person out. They're going to act like a victim. Then we come back around. They drop us off. They go into a 10 feet, 10 knot configuration. We jump off into the ocean, go make patient contact. Then they hoist us up and get back in. And we just repeated that all day. And it's this gorgeous day. And I'm sitting on the deck of this helicopter and I'm yelling at it, goes, I can't believe we're doing this. This is just crazy.
And this is our job, right? Yeah. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. How are we getting paid for this? You know, there's some poor person our age sitting in a cubicle looking at a computer, and they're going to do that for the next 30 years of their life. It's like, man, we're lucky. And I never forgot how lucky we were in having a career in the fire service. It was just the opportunities. And I have to attribute it to Cal Fire. The department, you know, it is one of the largest departments in the nation, but we've got so much diversity in our mission. Like, only the few things I didn't do is I was never on a truck company, was never on hazmat, and I wasn't in law enforcement. They asked me to get to the law enforcement side, but I said, I don't feel like going to the academy for 28 weeks. So, so no thanks. But yeah, so there was a lot of diversity in our mission for Cal Fire that we, a lot of us took an, it took advantage of, and just, we loved it. As far as now, I just like new challenges. So the adrenaline side, I'm done. I've checked all those boxes. I've gone to more incidents than I ever wanted to go to. But I'm always fascinated on especially technology projects that can make the fire service better and safer, more than importantly. If we can save lives, both, you know, firefighter lives, first responders, law enforcement, I think that's great. So that's kind of my next, I guess, things I look for in the future is more intellectual development of technologies that I can apply.
Lower testosterone, higher intellect.
What's that?
Lower testosterone, higher intellect.
Yeah, there you go. Well, not so high for me. Maybe Dan Reese, but I try to keep up.
Oh, I don't know. If you guys traded seats frequently, you're probably neck and neck there, right?
Yeah.
So you talked a lot about the value of technology, your fascination with technology, the necessity for technology as the workforce diminishes for whatever reason. We're going to have better technology to be able to do the same job if we have less people to throw at it. And while defining the needs of what that technology will do has to come from the end users, the development of the technology has to come from the private sector. What are the barriers to entry, which are significant for innovators taking an idea that would be well received by boots on the ground and well needed, but has to pass through this whole valley of death governmental process before it can ever see the light of day? What's being done to reduce those barriers to be able to speed up the move of technology from private sector to deployment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one of the big barriers from the private sector is obviously funding. So funding a technology project that may or may not be used by the fire service. I think some of the larger departments are actually looking at development. I think Cal Fire has actually done this, an R&D chief, like a research and development chief. They've had that for several years. So private sectors can come to this person, or they can go to the trade shows. And then this is the person that has not only fire experience, but tech experience, and can basically go, that's a good tech. I see value in that, or that's something I will probably never use. And this is why. One of the things I always thought that from the Cal Fire side is, and the fire service side is, we should never really own the technology. We should rent it because the capital investment for, and I was always cognizant for taxpayer dollars, like as an incident commander, I had to justify every cent I spent on an incident. At least I felt I had to. And I had all my team do the same thing. I go, remember, this isn't our money. This is public money. So we have to be able to validate what projects we're buying, why we're getting into them and doing them. So obviously there's some major capital stuff like the new Firehawk helicopters for Cal Fire, the S-70i.
$21 million last week, right? For that
big,
one
big chunk of money, way overdue. We were using Vietnam era helicopters, and from a safety standpoint. So I was happy to see those public dollars being invested in those significant aviation resources. That was great. And they're doing a lot of other capital investment in staffing and personnel, but there's going to be technology that, frankly, I've told them, I said, let's better us to rent it and let the private sector keep the software updated, keep the hardware updated. And, you know, so what we can do a lot of that through certain funding mechanisms in the department, where we have emergency funds and we have regular baseline funding, you know, budget stuff. So with those emergency funds, those are things where we can rent technology that we've already vetted and built it into our concept of operations or our planning and our operational side. But yeah, I think that's probably the some of the shortfalls is funding, and how do we invest that money into the department? And more importantly, how do we justify it to the public to execute it? Say, okay, yeah, we spent $21 million on a helicopter, but that's going to last for the next 20 years. It carries three times the payload, and we're going to be able to suppress, you know, most of the fires in San Diego with in certain conditions with these air resources. So yeah. So that's always been a challenge.
That doesn't mean that you couldn't have just, you know, called a company and said, hey, we want to lease this helicopter from you, and just, you know, you pay for the lease as long as that technology is appropriate for you. And when someone else has a better technology, you know, you move your dollars over to that.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You have a better command trailer, you know, do you have a better feeding system? Do you have a better water tender? Really it's what's available, to the right mission set. So what technology can we apply from the private sector? And a lot of what we look at is military. So the military technology tends to have a crossover into the fire service. So a lot of, for example, our, PPE, our protective equipment, changed dramatically from a double layer to a single layer. We did thousands of hours of research, and a lot of it was adapted from the military, you know, taking the uniforms the military is using, and they're in these horrible environments where it's hot, you know, dry. We were hurting more people with heat related emergencies, heat stroke, you know, heat exhaustion, than we were people getting burned. So they recognized that, but that was an example of adaptive technology from the military crossing over into the fire service.
Yeah, and I think for companies, or I'm taking a gamble on this being true, that the shortest route to commercialization, which would ultimately end up in new technology for the fire service, would be to define the value of that technology to the military. Right? If we have a new way to, you know, lay out retardant over enormous swaths of land, and we could sell that to Vandenberg Air Force Base, and that contract paid for the R&D and the original, you know, deployment research, then that technology now exists and can be sold at a, you know, more civilian related prices, you know, to the fire service.
That's exactly right.
Getting that DOD
budget DOD yeah. budget, state of California budget, local government budget, DOD budget is 100-fold greater. So it's a natural process where the military develops this great technology, whether it's unmanned systems, UAS, or where, you know, micro robots that can crawl on the ground to go spy on things. Well, we don't want to spy on things. We want to go find a victim in the same place.
Right.
So there's a lot of adaptive technology from the military just because they have that R&D budget that nobody else on the planet has.
Yeah, and even things that turned out to be really bad, you know, that came through DOD, like Agent Orange, you know, you could say, well, you know, could there be something safe that we could drop on the trees that would defoliate them immediately, so that we could lower the surface area to mass ratio of a tree and therefore diminish its ability to absorb heat and catch on fire? Right?
Yeah.
If it was lasers or something, right? Denude those trees instantly. It's going to be a lot harder to catch them without the leaves acting as the kindling.
Yeah. There's always pros and cons to technology. So it's just a matter of having the right people at the right place, help design. And I think that was the cool part about this MIT Lincoln Lab project, was the scientists were very open to feedback. So you've got a bunch of guys with pocket protectors, and they're all sitting in a room, and then they bring us in and they go, hey, do this. And we do it. And they're like, do you think that worked for you? And we went, yeah, some of it did, but here's some of the stuff you might want to fix. And they went, oh, okay. Right. So they're taking copious notes, you know, and modifying the software or adjusting some hardware portion. So, yeah.
So that feedback loop is essential, right?
Absolutely.
Any,
and I think that's
product development.
Maybe that's where that crossover is with the fire service as a whole, and tech companies. So how do we bridge that communication and need? So, yeah.
Well, you talked about leasing equipment versus buying equipment. What about taking that to the next step of contracting services rather than just equipment? You know, I'm pretty sure that if the post office bought all of the planes that FedEx had or leased them, it would still be the post office. It would still never have the efficiency and response capabilities that FedEx had. And FedEx is selling a service. It's not, you know, I don't care what kind of airplanes they use or what vans they're driving or whatever. Like, I just want my package there by 10 a.m.
Yeah.
So to what degree do you think there might be a market for the fire service to contract suppression as a service?
I think there's always going to be opportunities for agencies and departments to contract with a certain type of like a service delivery, if you will, that is not our niche. You know, the fire suppression side, we're pretty good at that. We've got good staff, we've got good technology, but is there going to be an agency or a private entity that has a certain piece of technology that really is going to enhance our mission to suppress fires or to protect the public? I think any agency would be crazy and not looking at that opportunity and evaluating that opportunity. And there's going to be some stuff that's, I would say, interesting from the private sector that is not really applicable. And then I'm going to say there's other stuff that's really just brilliant, you know? So there's some great chemical technologies out there that Dan was instrumental in working on and establishing. So there's some great aviation technology out there. I think the biggest thing, like if we could do it, is the situational awareness using AI. That's the utilization of AI is so new and so evolving that really what we should do as a fire service is step back and recognize we have no idea what we're doing with AI. What we need to do is hire somebody that knows AI that can be applied in an operational mission or a strategic mission based on feedback from us as an organization. We need to do these five objectives.
Yes.
And AI
do
that.
We need to supply some SMEs to a private company to inform the development of their product.
Right. So again, it goes back to that blend and that bridging of science and scientists, you know, engineers, and the people that have had 25 years on the ground and in the air of going, and they've got a million incidents in their head that they can see where this might apply and where, more importantly, where it may not apply. I think that's relevant because then from a capital investment of that private company, it's like, are you investing in the right direction with your technology? Just to come out and find out that the fire service is just going to laugh at you and go, we're not touching that, you know? So really that blend of, like you said, SMEs and science is critical, I think, to the future of the utilization of technology in the fire service.
Well, Ray, the way I ended up, you know, sitting in this seat is, you know, a few years ago, I was working as a volunteer firefighter and I saw, you know, how ineffective everything we did was, you know, basically being handed a set of medieval gardening tools and said, you know, go fight that wall of fire there, and thinking this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And talking with, you know, my fellow guys on the line there and asking the people who had been there a long time, you know, what would it take to get this fire out? And they said, you know, Steve, give it up. It would take a hurricane. You know, and having worked in Hollywood and building live special effects, I said, you know, we can make a hurricane. We can become the dominant wind force in any microclimate if we brought jet engines on the ground to drive retardant at 200 miles an hour at a fire. And so that led to a patent and funding and making a company, and then realizing that the complexity of operating that equipment would require that we provide that as suppression as a service, not just, hey, you know how to drive a fire truck. Great. Take this jet engine and blow out fires, right? There would be, you know, some level of specialization required to operate it, where it would behoove everyone, you know, that the equipment came with its operator, right? And that it came the whole tactical support system to not only know how to use that piece of equipment without blowing firefighters off the mountain, you know, but also knowing where that piece of equipment was best suited, where it could do its job best, where it would be most effective at, you know, stopping the advance of a fire.
Yeah.
So I feel like we're kind of, you know, we're going out on a lot of loose ground there, both in introducing a new technology, a new way to deploy it, and a new contracting method, you know, of suppression as a service. But it seemed like that business model was necessary based on the specialization of the technology.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I think innovation is key to advancing our technology and establishing that relationship with the private sector. And I think historically, from my experiences, we've been pretty good about hiring the right tool to show it's successful in an operational environment. I remember, it just came to mind, when I was an air attack captain at a Paso Robles, there was a company called Fire Snow. And this was essentially Fire Snow. And they essentially was a giant compressed air foam fire extinguisher that was slung underneath the helicopter. And so this thing would fly along like a big R2-D2 unit, it looked like. It's probably about 6 feet tall by about 4 feet wide. And it was a compressed air foam fire extinguisher. And
this aerial calves.
It would, yeah, it would go over, hover over a home and discharge one of the tanks, and the entire home would be under 6 inches of foam. Go back.
Yeah.
And it would go back to the main, to the loading dock on the back of the truck they had. And while one is flying, they're refilling the other one, and they would just switch out external load, just keep going. So that was,
that's great.
And we use that as what we call call when needed basis. So it would sit there for a while, but if there was a major incident, then we'd call them and go, hey, let's go to work. We're going to hire you for an hourly basis, you know? So I think, Cal Fire is real good at that. They're really good at contracting the right tool for the right job. If it's a proven technology, if they can show benefit to the taxpayer, and they can show enhancement to fire safety for staff, for the firefighters.
So what does the process look like for proving out the technology? I mean, you have to say, bring that thing up here. We'll light something on fire. You can blow it out. Like, is there are test forests and a set of folks that are responsible for evaluating the new tech?
Yeah. Yeah. Usually it starts with a phone call from the company to the SME and the local unit. So for Cal Fire, there's 21 operational units. So wherever they're based out of, they may make a phone call to the appropriate person to saying, hey, I think I've got some technology you guys might be interested in. How do I open up dialogue with your organization to start? We can have a conversation. And then that usually goes up the chain of command, and then they go, okay, let's have a meeting. They'll do an initial meeting. The company comes in, we have a conversation around the table. We ask a bunch of questions, you know, okay, what does it cost? Has it been used before? And if we need proof of concept, then I was always trying to utilize our prescribed fires. Like if we're doing vegetation management in a controlled environment, well, you've got a controlled environment with live fire that maybe you can apply the technology to see if it works. You know, but that's a very delicate thing, because now you've got a civilian technology on a sponsored vegetation management burn. So from a legal standpoint, you start looking at what's the liability if something goes wrong, the person in the company gets hurt. But those are all things that typically can probably be mitigated at a pretty high level. And I think for the Cal Fire side, that's usually at the Sacramento level. There's R&D people that are kind of the gateway into the department for that technology.
Okay. You said, you know, civilian technology, you know, isn't ultimately all technology is civilian technology?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I mean, the military may pay for the R&D, but that research and that product build and all that, like that's all done by, you know, companies. Yes,
absolutely. No, you're right.
Private market.
Yep.
Right. So when they say, you know, military grade, that just means, you know, the military paid a civilian company more money to make it a more reliable product.
Right.
Or at least to make it a more expensive product.
Yeah. And that brings up a great point. So we typically use Toughbook a lot. Toughbooks, you know, military grade. Very expensive. I got to the point where I'm like, honestly, why don't we use disposable technology? You know, let me buy an iPad. It breaks. I'll throw it away. I'll buy another one for $500.
Right.
Versus a $7,000 item, it'll do the same thing. So I was always a proponent of, okay, why are we, again, being cognizant of the taxpayer dollar, it's inefficient to buy this $8,000, $10,000 computer. Yeah, you can drop it off a 12-story building and it'll still work. But the reality is, do we need that? No.
Right.
Why don't we just do iPads or do, you know, a Dell computer for $325? It does the same thing. And if it breaks, I throw it away and get another one issued. So yeah, disposable technology. Disposable technology versus capital investments is one of the things that I was always looking at too. So
That's true, right? If you're looking for a new tool for a home improvement project, and you could go into Home Depot and they probably have that tool for $400, and then you could go to the Chinese distributor place and you could buy that tool for $30, and you say, well, it's probably not as good a tool, but I could go through 15 of them before I paid for one of those.
Exactly. And that's first thing unlikely. I do is go to Amazon, put it in. It's a third the price of whatever is in the field. Right. Like, it'll be delivered tomorrow. So exactly.
Yeah. So, maybe in the future we'll see Amazon for, I always thought of Viper as, Amazon for firefighters.
Yeah.
You get your stuff listed and then, people can order it.
Yep.
Well, I think, we got fascinating things to see in the future and Ray, I could continue this conversation with you for hours, but I'd like to break that up into individual hour sessions and we just continue this conversation on a regular basis. Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's great having a conversation with you and talking about stuff. So I really, really enjoyed it.
Well, hopefully the impact of these conversations is, that we see more innovation and we see more collaboration. And we see, vendors that each own a little piece of the puzzle starting to come together and, solve bigger chunks of it all at once.
I think we're in a very exciting time.
Yes.
I think there's some great emerging technology that's going to be really, really beneficial to the fire service in general. So, yeah. So it's exciting
time
to watch.
And well needed, right?
Absolutely.
As we see more and more fire on the ground and,
absolutely. And then
those that we didn't want.
Dan hit on this a little bit is, we're so steeped in tradition in the fire industry that we really need to take a step back and look at being more progressive in our use of technology. So, we're still using fire hoses and water technology from the, 1800s to put fires out. So nothing to say there's anything wrong with that because it's effective, it's economical. But let's also broaden our horizons at looking at new technologies and not just say, well, this is the way we've always done it. So why change? If it ain't broke, why fix it? It's like, maybe it's not broke, but maybe there's better stuff out there that we can.
Yeah. And maybe it's not going to be up to the challenge much longer when water supplies are scarce and fires are less scarce.
Exactly.
So we'll see.
And we've seen. I'm not a big climate change person, but I'll tell you, my first fire season was like 90 days. My first fire season in Temecula, I was laid off like within 3 months just because fire activity was so low. Now it's year round. So 40 years later, so you definitely see a change in our fires and our fire behavior. And I could get into a whole nother session with you on that, but we're not. The mega fires are going to continue and droughts will continue and the fire behavior will continue. So we definitely need to look at technology to help us with that emerging threat.
Before I let you go, let me ask you just to follow up on that. When you said you're not a big climate change person, does that mean that you dispute the data about what's happening in the climate or you have questions about what the causation is?
Both. Unfortunately, from what I read, the initial climate data was compromised. Several was that 10 years ago, or whatever. So, but I can tell you just from, again, kind of my knuckle dragging firefighter hat is fires are changed. Fires have changed. So, and I think that there's something within the environment that's doing that. I'm not sure if it's climate change that's doing that or something else that's doing that, but I can tell you our fires in general have become more extreme and more more prevalent. That's a fact.
Well, if you've read Fire Weather, then fire is in fact one of the climate factors. So if fires are changing, the climate is changing.
Right? Yeah,
because the climate includes fire. So you're changing one of the big variables in it.
Yeah, I mean, look at in San Diego, we just had Coronado had 2 inches of rain in less than an hour. I mean, that's insane. I mean, we've never had that happen here. Last time that happened was back in like 1820 or something like that, they said. So there's definitely something happening with the weather. There's definitely something happening with our fires. So let's apply forward thinking and be open to new ideas and concepts and new technologies to help keep the public and keep the firefighters safe.
Absolutely. Ray, we're going to pick this up again. I'm going to send you an invitation to join me again next month. And
awesome.
Because I think we're going down some productive roads here. Ray, thanks so much for joining me today.
It was great talking with you, Steve. Thank you so much.
You bet. All right. Well, you've been listening to The Fire Break, or even watching The Fire Break, so you can compare, you know, your thoughts on the relative good lookingness of Ray Cheney to Dan Reese. And we're going to have a poll that we introduce later. You can actually vote for which one you prefer. This is a long standing competition between these guys. That will give you a chance to weigh
Don't
in
do that,
on.
Please, I'm going to get my feelings hurt if you do a survey.
Thanks for joining us here on The Fire Break. Look forward to seeing